ends entwined, white against the darkness. Lovers seeking a quiet spot. How amazing that this could still exist. It made her think of her own love, and of the letter she had stowed away in the little wooden chest. Without it, she would be lost. Chapter 15. Erenheim, May 1950. Anya surveyed the party from her seat at the head of the long table, which Wolfgang had assembled using planks from the old hayloft. There were so many cousins, neighbors, and old friends of Karsten's in line to shake her hand and offer congratulations in their formal small-town manner. Beyond Marianne, Benita, and the children, there was no one here from Anya's own life.
"Is there really no family?" Karsten had pressed. "No aunts and uncles? No friends from childhood?"
Anya stood firm.
"Family dead? Friends lost? It's only a party," she had reassured him. "I have my boys."
This last part she meant. It was the most important thing. The thing from which all others stemmed. This marriage was for them, although she had not seen either of her boys since the party began. Wolfgang was probably outside somewhere, his stiff new shoes cast aside, playing soccer with his school friends. And Anselm, shy Anselm, was probably holed up in his room studying. Wolfgang would take over the farm some day. By the old German laws, it should have been Anselm as the oldest son. But Anselm wanted to attend university and become a scientist.
Herr und Frau Kellermann?
An old man donned his cap and beamed. The aging father of the town dressmaker, and a known pervert.
"To be married is to be closer to heaven," he said,
a strand of spittle gleaming from one corner of his mouth. This was rich, coming from Herr Betz. The town was full of pretense. No one here demanded truth. Which was fine by Anya. To them, she was simply a DP from the East, one of those desperate people they had been forced to make room for in their homes and invite into their children's schools and support with their hard-earned Deutsche Marks. And now she was Karsten Kellermann's wife. They did not want to plumb the depths.
"God bless you. May God keep you."
The guests approached with their pieties and gifts. Now that Hitler was gone, they had all returned to being devout Catholics. But who was Anya to judge? Anya clasped their hands and ducked her head and gave thanks.
"What a lovely party," Marianne said,
suddenly standing beside her. Anya smiled, happy to see her friend. Marianne was much taller and bonier than the Erenheim Hausfraus, and looked out of place in her fine dress. Out of her element, too, as a guest. The woman was most at ease when she was in charge, striding around the DP camp with donated blankets, conducting interviews or dictating letters for Anya to type.
"Don't get up," Marianne said. "You are the king and queen of this celebration. You must stay on your thrones." "Herr Kellermann," she turned to Karsten, "you have outdone yourself."
This was not Karsten's kind of talk.
"Gnädige Frau," he stammered, "we are honored to have you here."
"And we are honored to be here,"
Marianne said, slipping into her more formal, talking-across-barriers voice.
"Will you bring some of the food home, Marianne?"
Anya began, and then stopped as she saw a short, round-faced man approaching with his camera, Herr Bremer. At this point in the evening, she had thought she was safe.
"Frau Grabarek,"
Herr Bremer called, and then stopped.
"No, Frau and Herr Kellermann."
He swept his cap off his head and folded himself into a theatrical bow.
"My apologies for being late, but there is an excuse."
He reached behind his back.
My new flash.
In the paper you will look beautiful and bright as day, even in the middle of the night.
Anya blanched.
It had been Karsten's idea to have their photo accompany the wedding announcement. Anya had protested, but the decision was made. In his desire for their marriage to be recorded, she had stumbled on some hidden strand of vanity in him. A wish to show the world his new life.
This will be a fine place for our work,
Herr Bremer said, his eyes twinkling as he set the camera down and attached the flash. He was an insidious little man, the former photo editor of the local Nazi paper, famous for his extensive catalog of racial portraits. Though, of course, no one talked about this. Anya shifted uncomfortably in her seat.
A few casual pictures first, Herr Bremer said,
lifting the black box to his eye. Anya blinked and the camera flashed. Beside her, she felt Karsten draw back. The guests began to gather around, and the fiddle player stopped. The camera flashed again, and Anya gripped the edges of her chair as if she might fall off.
Now, one standing over here,
Herr Bremer directed, pointing the camera into the circle of guests and taking a few candid shots. Several of the men drew back.
Like an interrogation,
someone grumbled.
Anya tried to smile.
Ready?
Bremer said.
Jawohl,
Karsten answered with surprising strength. Then they stood together, side by side against the wall like victims of an execution, pinned by the flash.
Chapter 16. Tollingen, May 1950. So there were to be new chapters. This was the happy feeling that filled Marianne after Anya's wedding. To see her friend married to a good man, a good German man, almost an extinct species, this was a hopeful thing. Her dear Anya, stalwart companion, comforting presence, perpetual enigma, was to begin a new life. But if she was honest with herself, Marianne also felt a twinge of grief. It was the end of their partnership. In the past years, she and Anya had volunteered together at the local displaced persons camp. Even now, 200,000 refugees remained in German camps. But Karsten would need Anya on the farm. It was half the reason he had married her. Anyone could see that. He was aging, and Anya was strong. She would have to work like a horse. And she would have no more time for Marianne's schemes and projects and lists. Marianne would have no one to bounce her ideas off, to type up her letters, to help her sort boxes of library books. Today, Marianne was hosting a send-off party for the last DPs at the camp, a group of Estonian Jews. This was the camp Anya had first landed in, recreated in the last years as a camp for Jewish survivors. In the beginning, everyone had been mixed up. Nazi collaborators thrown into the same dormitories as Polish nationalists, gypsies, and Jews. Concentration camp guards with former inmates. Thank God they had changed that. Over the past year, Marianne had completed enough paperwork on the Estonians' behalf to sink a ship. And her efforts had finally paid off. They were granted entry to the United States. Signor Carfolo, the International Refugee Organization official responsible for the camp, had been skeptical about the celebration. For such an emotional thing, the last refugees, the final survivors of their small community. A party. The man was not very Italian. But Marianne knew that if she planned it, he would enjoy himself. It was the Tuesday after Anya's wedding, blustery and cool. Marianne waited at the camp's front gate for Anya, and also for Benita, who had reluctantly agreed to help them set up. The area looked desolate now, the barracks empty except for the building where the Estonians lived, The delousing station long since shuttered, and the cook fires replaced by kitchenettes.
Good riddance. But today, as Marianne stood in the silence, she missed the old bustle and restless energy. It had served as a physical manifestation of the war, evidence, and now it too would be erased. With the departure of these last refugees, the camp would be demolished and rebuilt as modern apartment-style housing.
"What would you think of all this?" she asked Albrecht.
"And Connie?" Connie would have been especially disgusted by the town's proposals. After all, before the DPs, the site had been a Wehrmacht barracks and training camp.
"Burns a place down, erect a terrible monument," he would have declared. He had never been a pragmatist.
"You are not a real German," Marianne had so often teased him on account of this. He was a romantic and an idealist. Just as her thoughts turned glum, Marianne saw Anya arrive, driven by Herr Kellermann. Two fine new horses pulled his wagon, but the wagon itself was the same one he had first met Marianne and her children with, so many years ago.
"Won't you join us for the celebration?"
Marianne asked as he helped unload the food.
"Nah," Kellermann shook his head with a sheepish smile and offered no excuse.
"What a feast you have prepared," Marianne exclaimed, seeing the two cakes her friend had baked.
There was a whole pot of sausages and bread and cheese as well. Anya always knew how to feed a large group.
"Where did you learn to cook in such quantities?"
Marianne had once asked.
"Just instinct," Anya demurred. "Let's set up in the library," Marianne said. "The dining hall is too gloomy for a party. Never mind what Signor Carfolo says. After all," she turned to Anya slyly, "it's our library, isn't it?"
The library was nothing fancy. A large room with bookshelves and a comfortable table and chairs. But it had been Marianne's idea, and she had been right. It was a great success. The DPs had relished access to books, and Marianne had collected and organized them herself. As Marianne and Anya approached, a few children ran toward them. Arne Alver, Lee Pulver, Jana and Eha Massing. These last two were sweet, rosy-cheeked twins, born right here in the camp. Members of a surprising peacetime baby boom.
"Have you bought things for the party?"
Lev asked in his near-perfect English.
"Kuchen?"
Eha asked, bouncing with excitement. This was a German word all the children had learned, whether or not their parents approved.
"Cake, yes,"
Marianne corrected, in deference to their mother, Jutta, who stood in the doorway of their apartment.
"And lots of spinach soup?"
The children squealed and shrieked in mock horror. Spinach soup was what they had eaten for breakfast, lunch, and dinner during the early days of the camp.
"Süßigkeiten?"
Jana tugged Anya's skirt. "Sweets." The children loved Anya, who spoke little English and no Estonian, but somehow seemed, always, to grasp what they wanted. In the presence of these children, Marianne saw her smile far more than she ever did with her own sons. Anya had cared for some of the children since they were newborns. When the camp administration had placed an ad in town for local women to serve as nannies, for babies whose mothers were too sick after the war, or too traumatized, Marianne had pressed Anya to apply. And Anya had proved a deft and patient nanny, swaddling the babies in old army blankets, coaxing them to swallow their sugared vitamin water from medicine droppers. Her silence put the families at ease.
"You're so good at this," Marianne had once remarked,
and was startled to see tears spring to her friend's eyes.
"Let us arrange the party, and we'll call you in," Marianne said to the children.
She nodded her head toward the residence where she could see Jutta waving.
How tall and strong the woman looked. So different from the diminished figure she had once been. Marianne waved back, surprised to find tears pressing at her own eyes. All the men in Jutta's family were dead, executed by one of Hitler's Einsatzgruppen. "Now," she announced once they had entered the library, "we must make a beautiful end." The party was set to begin when Benita burst through the door. "There you are," she exclaimed, her cheeks flushed. "I can never find my way in this place." She looked particularly lovely this morning, and the waft of high spirits she brought with her was contagious. "Anya," Benita said, beaming, "how is this new married life?" "Not so different than before," Anya shrugged. "Oh, really?" Benita said with a twinkle in her eye. To Marianne's surprise, the other woman did not blush. "A man wants what he wants," Anya said demurely, and they both laughed. Marianne busied herself with the tablecloth. "Marianne, you're shocked," Benita said, some combination of her light mood and Anya's presence making her brash. "Me?" Marianne asked, although it was true. She had never shared this sort of banter with Anya, or Benita, for that matter. "Of course," Benita smirked. "Anya can't very well shock herself." "Don't be so sure," Anya said, surprising Marianne into laughter that chased away the echo of her old school marmishness. "That I'd like to see," Benita said. "Frau Kellermann shocking herself." Their laughter subsided into comfortable silence. From outside they could hear the children playing, and with the tablecloths and food unpacked, the library took on a festive look. "I almost forgot," Benita said. "I brought us ice wine." She reached into her bag and held a bottle aloft. "Herr Reiner said it was the best." Benita opened the bottle and poured them each a glass. "To you too," she said, "and all the hard work you have put into this place." "Posh, we can't drink to ourselves." "To the travelers," Marianne began. Benita cut her off. "Then to marriage, to love, and to whoever is next." With a coy smile, she brought her glass to her lips. Marianne regarded her, suddenly curious. "Why? Is there someone?" Benita shrugged mischievously. "Who knows? Where Anya goes, we may follow." "You don't mean Helmut?" Marianne frowned, perplexed. The wine had gone straight to her head. "How do you know I mean me, and not you?" "Benita," Marianne exclaimed. "What on earth can you be talking about?" Benita sashayed over to the window and rested her forehead against the glass. For a moment, Marianne was reminded of the girl she had first met. Then Benita straightened, cocked her head, and smiled. "Nonsense," she said, "and daydreams. Don't you ever have those?" "Oh, Benita," Marianne shook her head. She stabbed a knife into the cake on the table and began slicing. "Isn't it time for the party to begin?" "You should," Benita smiled, ignoring the question. "A few daydreams would do you good." Chapter 17. Mommsen, June 1950. As far as Marianne knew, Benita was going to visit her sister. "Bring her this," Marianne had said that morning, thrusting a bag of expensive oranges into her hands. It gave Benita a twinge of guilt. Marianne was a good woman. She knew Benita's sister Lotta had 4 children and worked long hours in a canning factory. She did not know that Lotta was an ignorant, hard-hearted bitch, and her husband was not dead, but locked in some Siberian camp for XSS. Or that Benita was not actually going to see Lotta. In Mommsen, Benita stood for a moment on the makeshift train platform, blinking in the spring sunlight. Then she spotted him. Franz Müller. Always taller and broader in person than he was in her mind. It was as if he belonged to another species. All parts of him well-proportioned, but larger. A superhuman. She loved this. When he saw her, a shy smile spread across his face. Franz, she called, and ran toward him. Circumspect, as always, he extended his hand.
Oh, stop,
Benita said, wrapping her arm around his waist. She turned her face up to his.
You can at least give me a kiss.
He obliged with a furtive peck on her lips.
You would think I'd be the one who didn't want to be seen,
she laughed. Come. He swung her bag over his shoulder where it perched ridiculously. Benita thrust her hand into his. Wrapped in the warmth of his calloused palm, her own felt like some small, vulnerable mollusk. She trailed a step behind, enjoying the feel of following, of being led by someone so much bigger and stronger than herself, and of knowing it was an illusion. When they were together, she was the one in charge. When Franz had been released from the internment camp, he was a thin, hollow-eyed man with an apologetic stoop. He had hitched a ride to Braunschweig, first with a transport of American soldiers, who called him old man and offered him a candy bar that later had him retching in a ditch, and then with a friendly Tommy driving a jeep. This was the freezing winter of 1946. Benita knew all this from the letters he had written her soon after his release. Such sweet, simple letters, asking how she was, what Martin was doing, whether the castle was warm enough. At first, she had been self-conscious about writing back, but then it had seemed cruel not to answer. She missed his strong, quiet presence in the woods. So she had made herself respond. And what fun this turned out to be. It made her notice more, think more, and find the humor and interest in little things. The chickens Marianne was raising proved endlessly entertaining. It was a miracle that they survived under her care. And Fritz and Martin's mischief became less galling when she wrote about it. Life was so much brighter and more vivid once she had a reason to observe it closely. Everything was fodder for her letters. Except for the Russian. But of course, he hung between them. Their personal ghost. A man she had killed and Franz had buried. To everyone else, he didn't exist. He had simply vanished from the face of the earth. On that day in the woods, Franz had seen Benita's most hideous self, and still he did not hate her. Somehow, it saved her from hating herself. Through their letters, they learned more about each other. Franz was the oldest son of a carpenter, who made fine cabinets and furniture. At 19, he had married the daughter of his father's partner in order to consolidate the business. She was a sickly girl, 5 years older than he was. They had one daughter, Clotilde, and his wife died 2 years later. So Franz and his father had raised the girl, who was now 11, the same age as Martin. He was not conscripted until 1942. He was older, for one thing, already 35 when the war began, and the sole proprietor of a business. But finally he had been sent east as part of a local group of reservists. What it was like there, where he had been, he did not write about this. Anyway, she knew where he had ended up. Berglingenfels, cutting down trees. After he was released from the internment camp, he had gathered up his small family. Their flat had been bombed, his business destroyed, and he found Clotilde and old Herr Müller living in a dank, overcrowded apartment with neighbors. So he had packed their things and moved south to the American sector, where there were more opportunities. And there was Benita. In the city of Mommsen, he could find work as a carpenter. "Why not Tollingen?" Benita wrote. "Come back as a free man." But Franz had a cousin who had a friend who owned a coffin-making business in Mommsen, and Franz was assured of work there. Demand for coffins was steady, he joked. And it was not far from Tollingen. So their letters had continued. But now there were also visits. Over the last 2 years, Benita had been to Franz's flat above the coffin business several times. She had met old Herr Müller, who was bitter and unpleasant, and spoke to his son as if he were still 12 years old. How did Franz stand it? And little Clotilde, who was a sweet thing, all skin and bones and large, soulful, dark eyes. She clearly needed a mother, someone to teach her how to put her hair back in something other than a plain braid, how to look people in the eye, how to keep the house. They had sat on the makeshift furniture Franz crafted from coffin scraps and eaten Clotilde's homemade, nearly inedible cookies. And Benita had daydreamed of all the ways she could improve on this. Today, Benita and Franz were alone. Clotilde and her grandmother had taken the train north to visit Franz's ailing sister. As soon as they entered the flat, Benita turned and hooked her hands into his waistband. Franz took her fingers in his and brought them to his lips. Still holding them, he walked her backward to the brand new sofa, yellow with stiff cushions, under the open window. "What are you doing?" Benita laughed, pulling away her hands.
"Bringing you to the sofa," Franz said. "Making you sit? Getting your cup of tea?"
"But I don't want tea," she protested, catching his hand as she sat back, with a poof on the cushion.
"I insist," he said, pulling away. "A lady deserves tea after a long journey."
"Oh, a lady," she said. "How fine. And how has the gentleman been?"
"Lonely," Franz said, lighting the gas under the kettle. "Waiting for your visit."
"But now he wants to wait even longer,"
Benita teased, batting her lashes and watching him blush.
A widower, a soldier, a man nearing 46, and still such an innocent. With him, she adopted the old role of flirt and temptress that had once been her signature. She slipped off her shoes and tucked her feet underneath her on the sofa.
"How was the wedding?"
he asked, measuring tea into the strainer. He was so careful and considerate, traits she would have hated in her young life, but that now endeared him to her. His carefulness made her feel safe.
"Wonderful," Benita said. "The bride wore a gray suit, and the groom his best lederhosen."
She laughed aloud at the image of Herr Kellermann in a pair of short pants. "No, but really, it was nice. Anya looked happy, at least secretly."
Franz handed Benita a steaming cup, thick white china, the kind one could buy at any market now. So different from Marianne's fine Meissen. Benita would miss those when she became Frau Müller, their refinement and air of bygone elegance. But she held no more illusions. She could eat off fine china, but she would never be an aristocrat.
"Franz," she said, hooking her foot around his leg as he started back for his own cup. "Franzl."
She loved calling him that. It was such a boy's name, so inappropriate for the man before her.
"And will you make me a good woman? Have you been looking at flats?"
His face slackened. And immediately, Benita wished she had not teased. Franz would find one when there was enough money, she had no doubt. And then they would be married. It was only a question of time.
"Not yet," he said as if breaking terrible news. "I'm sorry. I think it will be another month."
"Hush. Never mind. I'm only teasing."
She ran her stockinged foot farther up his leg.
"But now you must stop teasing me."
Slowly, Franz leaned down and took the cup of tea from her hand, placing it on the side table. Then he pulled her to her feet. She pressed her breasts against his chest, delighted by their regained roundness in her new brassiere, a white lace shelf that created real décolletage. It was the first piece of lingerie she had owned since before the war. In it, she felt young again and excited by her own beauty.
"That's better,"
she murmured against his lips and unbuttoned her dress. They made love 4 more times during the 24-hour visit. It was never enough. Benita had always cultivated her seduction skills. Connie was not her first, and her husband had benefited from her experience. There was Heinrich Kohl and Karl Josef before him, handsome, fresh-faced village boys with whom she had practiced, with the explicit intention of gaining expertise. She was a dreamer, but she was not naive. She had always known that it was not her brains that would get her out of Frühlinghausen. And so she had learned how to slip her tongue into the rim of a man's ear just so. How to graze her nipples against his chest, a titillating reminder of their presence, as she slid one hand down over his belly to the ridge of his hip. With Connie, all this had come together in an impressive bit of theater that he had loved. For a man of experience, which Connie Fledermann certainly was, he had been oddly enthralled by her simple games, and she had used that to every advantage. But for her, the benefit was only his addled affection, never any pleasure of her own. With Franz, it was different. There was no pretending. After Berlin, sex was something she had never thought she would want again. Yet somehow she did. She wanted him. And around him she had no shame. "Franz," she said, rising on her elbow sometime before dinner on the second day. Her stomach rumbled. They had eaten nothing except Marianne's oranges and chocolate, and the sugar made her light-headed.
"Let's go to Lufner's. I could eat 5 schnitzels."
Franz rolled onto his back. They were pressed against each other and lying on his cot, a rudimentary thing that he didn't entirely fit into even on his own. He slept on this, his father on the couch, and Clotilde in the bedroom. The flat Benita envisioned for the future Frau Müller was to be much bigger, with a room for each and a proper wardrobe for Clotilde. She had spent hours daydreaming of this.
"Jawohl,"
Franz said, swinging his giant legs off the bed.
"Whatever Frau Fledermann wishes."
While Franz was in the washroom, Benita scribbled a note to tuck into his underwear drawer. It was a silly little thing on a scrap of package paper. "I love you," and a picture of a goat with hearts for eyes. She did not mean to snoop. But suddenly, when she pulled out the drawer, here were his most intimate things. Not only underwear, but a framed photograph of a woman who must have been his mother, square-jawed and regal-faced, with Franz's high forehead. Another of Clotilde as a baby, and a box full of letters Benita had sent to him. Beneath these, she noticed the corner of another letter, something official and typewritten. Almost without thinking, she pulled it out. It was a directive from the Spruchkammer, the local denazification council, dated August 1946.
"We have found Franz Müller to belong to Group 3, lesser offenders, subject to sanctions accordingly."
Group 3 was an unlucky designation, a step beyond Mietläufer, or a fellow traveler, which was the title every German liked to think he deserved. It was not as bad as Belastet, or loaded, meaning guilty, a strange term in itself. But it signified guilt nonetheless. A Group 3 designation entailed restrictions. You could not, for instance, teach or play a role in politics. Why had Franz kept the letter? In the last year, under Adenauer, such designations had become nearly irrelevant. Germany was in the Cold War now. The Soviets were their enemy once again, not the Nazis.
"I'm sorry," Franz said, his voice startling her.
"For what?"
Benita asked, coloring. The letter was still clutched in her hand.
"I should have told you."
"Told me what?"
"That everyone is guilty."
Franz did not seem angry, to her relief.
"Don't you think the Americans have made that clear?"
Franz remained solemn.
"You've never asked me about the war."
"Why should I?"
She approached him.
"You were in the reserve. You went to the east. You fought the Russians.
I don't need to know any more."
Franz was silent.
"What? I don't?"
Somewhere inside, a small pot of fear split open, sending doubt rattling.
"Do I?"
"I don't know, Benita." Franz sighed. "I can't tell you what you need to know."
Benita stopped a meter away and felt the distance between them open like a vice. It filled her with panic. She could not lose him. She could not survive this.
"I know you,"
she said, flinging her arms around him.
"That's all I need."
Franz stiffened and averted his face.
"Franzl,"
she pleaded,
"we are new people now. This is our second life."
For a terrifying moment, he did not move. Then slowly, as if navigating some viscous substance, he lifted his arms and wrapped them around her and touched his lips to the crown of her head.
"Thank God."
But as she held him tight, she could feel the presence of the past. A great, unknowable continent of experience pushing up between them, full of treacherous mountains and dry valleys. She did not want to explore it. When they returned to the flat from Lufner's Biergarten, the door opened from within.
"Papa!"
Clotilde cried. Her eyes lit up and then widened as she noticed her father was not alone in the hall.
"What happened?"
Franz stuttered.
"You came home early. Is everything all right?"
"Bärbel was sick. Not terribly sick, just not well. And so we took the earlier train to allow her peace and quiet."
She continued to stare at Benita.
"You remember Frau Fledermann?"
Franz said, collecting himself.
"Frau Fledermann?"
Clotilde said, politely ducking her head, then raising it to peer curiously back and forth between Benita and her father.
"Don't let the draft in,"
old Herr Müller called from within.
"Have you brought the meat for supper yet?"
he asked as they entered. He was reclined on the yellow sofa, facing away from the door.
"Father,"
Franz said, and turning slightly, Herr Müller caught sight of Benita. His eyes widened and his mouth fell open.
"You remember Frau Fledermann?"
Franz said, placing a hand at her elbow. Herr Müller nodded but remained speechless.
"Don't get up,"
Benita said, crossing the floor with her hand extended. The old man stared at her. He was tall even now, and his face was much like Franz's, although not as handsome or as kind. A series of emotions, confusion, anger, and suspicion passed across it. And Benita remembered her valise, lying open on Franz's cot. Had Herr Müller seen it?
Have you had a comfortable trip?
She asked hastily. For a moment, both Clotilda and the old man stared.
Frau Fledermann is on her way to the train herself,
Franz interrupted. His own face had turned a florid red.
I will take her to the station and pick up the meat on my return.
Herr Müller gave a peremptory nod. In his manner, and in Franz's sudden uncertainty, Vinita saw their history. Here was the domineering father for whom Franz had married a sickly woman and become a carpenter.
May I come too?
Clotilde asked, breaking her silence.
Please?
I don't think... Franz began.
Oh, why not?
Vinita said warmly.
We can hear all about your trip. Please?
Clotilde pleaded.
All right. Franz ducked his head.
Is that your valise?
Clotilde asked guilelessly, pointing to the cot.
Thank you,
Vinita answered smoothly.
We stored it there for the day so we could walk into the park. Franz?
She turned to her lover, who had suddenly become an overgrown boy in his awkwardness.
Can you get it for me?
Ah, of course.
He crossed the room in three great strides. Vinita smiled brightly at Clotilde. Franz rejoined Vinita at the door with the valise.
Frau Fledermann and I are betrothed,
he announced, almost fiercely, taking her arm. And for a moment, they, Vinita, Herr Müller, and Clotilde, all stared at him, gape-mouthed. Clotilde was the first to speak.
Congratulations, she said shyly. Thank you,
Vinita said, smiling broadly at Franz, surprised at the enormity of her own happiness. Chapter 18 Erenheim, June 1950. The photograph in the newspaper made Anya look frightened, and Karsten proud and foolish.
You were right, he announced bitterly. It would have been better not to invite that photographer.
No, no, Anya lied. No one looks at those pictures anyway.
A month had passed, and so far this seemed to be true. But each night she had terrible dreams. In these she was no longer on the march. She was a girl in her father's house.
Anya,
Herr Dr. Fortzmann would say in his stern, sonorous voice.
It is vanity to think you can change fate.
She would wake in a sweat, her featherbed soaked. And when she saw her own dim reflection in the mirror, she mistook it for a ghost. Married life was not very different from her life as a tenant. As a paying boarder on Karsten's farm, Anya had grasped his intentions early. He was certainly not flirtatious. God forbid, even the idea was alarming. But he was solicitous. And her responsibilities were already those of a wife. Cooking, cleaning, ironing his shirts. So Karsten's unadorned offer of matrimony had not come as a surprise. And once she agreed, there was no sense in abiding by old-fashioned traditions of propriety. Neither of them was religious, neither was a virgin. And for both, their union was a utilitarian arrangement. Karsten favored swift, silent encounters with no pretense of romance. They slept in separate bedrooms, but from the first day of their engagement, he had maintained a regular schedule of visits. Tuesdays and Fridays. He had not deviated from it once. Which explained why, at the start of her marriage, she found herself undeniably pregnant. 5 months along, the village doctor confirmed with unsubtle amusement,
Herr Kellermann will certainly be pleased.
He grinned. But Anya was not amused. Denial had shielded her from the fact for as long as possible. Her cycles had been irregular since the war, and she had convinced herself she was too old to have children. Meanwhile, her belly grew round, and she was hungry all the time. There was a flush of fat on her cheeks. Her pregnancy was too far along to escape. Even so, she tried. She rode the wagon over rutted fields, scrambled up ladders and jumped down from the odd places the hens laid eggs, initiated a rigid program of bitter teas and scalding baths. She did not tell Karsten the news, but the baby was stubborn. It clung to her like a barnacle. She imagined its tiny fists grasping the soft tissue of her womb. It was determined to survive. When she finally told Karsten, he was both delighted and embarrassed. He never spoke of the pregnancy by name and made no changes to their daily life, except for the conjugal visits, which immediately ceased. Anya did not tell anyone. Let Karsten and Dr. Schrenke, the old gossip, spread the word. In the evenings, Karsten liked to sit with her in the parlor, an uncomfortable dark room with nothing but the fire in the brazier to recommend it. They listened to the news on the radio, and he forced himself to read the Bible, self-imposed penance for a man who never went to church. As he read, his lips shaped the words. Anya sat beside him in the reclining armchair he had given her as a wedding present, darning socks and half-hearing the news. Sometimes Wolfgang ventured into their little cocoon with a question about schoolwork. Unlike his brother, he was a terrible student. He hunched over his books like a man flinching from a blow. The softer subjects were of particular difficulty. The vague but cautionary parables of history, the dense imaginative formulas of literature. He could not wait to work full-time on the farm, and genuinely enjoyed making the rounds with his stepfather, learning how to stack the baled hay, when to hose down the pigs, where to reinforce a fence. He didn't even mind Karsten's finicky and exacting commands. Next fall, his official apprenticeship was set to begin. Yet Anya always felt a twinge of sorrow at the sight of his dark head bowed over his schoolwork. He was her mistake, poor child, born at a time when only wickedness was being ushered into the world. He was the product of her hungry, ration-fed womb and thin, insufficient breast milk. As a young mother, she had not had time to care for him. When he was sick with scarlet fever as a toddler, she had tied him to the bedpost on a leash to quarantine him. Karsten's farm was her way of making amends.
"Here is something for you," Karsten said from his armchair one evening, extending an envelope with "Frau Anya Kellermann" written across the front. The baby hiccuped in her belly.
"Thank you," Anya said, her heart suddenly pounding. She did not recognize the address, a street in Mommsen. But the name, R. Brandt, took her breath away. She sat rigidly still, terrified that Karsten would ask her about its sender. The torrent of chemicals in her womb made the hiccuping stop. Thankfully, Karsten was engrossed in a seed catalog. Anya resumed her mending. The minutes sagged. The pages of Karsten's magazine rustled. It was weaning season, and outside the mother cows bellowed for their calves. Across the pasture, in the barn, the calves cried back. But when enough time had elapsed, Anya excused herself. Behind the closed door of her room, she tore open the envelope. Inside was a thin sheet of airmail paper, the script written in a shaky but familiar hand. "Anya," it read, "do I recognize you? Yours, as always, Rainer." The words swam before her eyes. She tried to focus on the uneven ink, the fussy elegance of the A and the D, a kind of pidgin old German script he had taught himself. After everything, apparently, this pretense remained. From where had he emerged? Missing, presumed dead. This was what she had found at the Red Cross office.
dead, she had thought. After all, she knew the Vortigau, and she knew Reiner, or at least she once had.
But here he was, on this scrap of paper, slipping into her life.
The truth will out,
her father had always said. Though so far in Anya's experience this was not quite right. The truth was in God's hands, or the devil's, more likely. The very word, truth, seemed quaint. Where had it been hiding during the reign of obedience, pride, and duty? Anya lay on her bed and counted the rows of tiny flowers on the curtains to still the chaos in her head. But it seeped through. In her mind, doors banged open and shut. The stench of mud defrosting in the spring. The long blank horizon of the east. The cruelty of boys playing games in the cold. A baby's hand absently pulling at her ear. Beneath this were other softer pieces. Reiner, not as the man she had last seen, but as a boy, sitting on the horsehair sofa in her father's waiting room, waiting for his own prematurely aged father to emerge with a new round of pills. Already he had been the man of the house, dark-haired and dark-eyed, his feet barely reaching the floor. Still, he was in charge. She rose abruptly and went to the desk. She had to write back. If there was one thing she had learned, it was that you had to act, to rise up and meet the obstacles thrown in your path. To sit and wait was death. She pulled a sheet of airmail paper from her desk.
"I'm afraid you are mistaken," she wrote. "I know no one by the names of Anya or Reiner Brandt. Best of luck."
For a long moment she sat, staring at the words and at the once intimate name, Brandt. Then she sealed the envelope and tiptoed down the hall to the room her boys shared. She stood before their door and listened. She could hear their voices within. Anselm's low murmur, Wolfgang's faster, more heated tone. What would they make of the news? Her boys, for whom she had done too little, and from whom she had asked so much. Total faith, total amnesia, total forgiveness. Something made her hesitate. As she stood in the darkness, a new intention formed. She would shoulder this new uncertainty alone. It was hers, after all. So she listened a moment more, allowing her courage to be bolstered by the trappings of this ordinary life she had arranged. Homework, supper, chores, bed. Then, moving swiftly and quietly, she turned and went back down the hall. Chapter 19. Tollingen, June 1950. Marianne was in the middle of a dream when the doorbell rang. A sweet, long-ago dream from her last life, of sitting in the garden at Weislau, a picnic under the chestnut tree with her children, the dogs, and Albrecht. And then all the gaiety disappeared. She was not in Weislau, but in her flat in Tollingen. The plot had failed. Weislau was lost. Albrecht was dead. Marianne sat up. Late afternoon sunlight streamed through the windows, illuminating dust motes and uneven layers of floor wax. It was still day. Without her work at the camp, she found herself napping at odd times and reading deep into the night. It was embarrassing. She swung her legs off the sofa. It was likely Benita, having forgotten her key, of course.
"Welcome home," she said, opening the door,
hoping there were no telltale wrinkles from the pillow on her face.
"Where are your keys?" "I'm sorry,"
Benita blushed.
"I must have left them on the table, or when I was..." "Come in, come in,"
Marianne commanded.
"It's too cold in the hall. How is your sister?"
"My sister?"
Vinita looked surprised.
Oh, yes. She's well. Thank you.
She's well? Marianne asked.
I thought she was ill again.
As well as possible.
Marianne studied Vinita. She was, as usual these days, in a state of heightened spirits. She seemed overexcited, in fact. Something had happened. She could not step over a dead cat on the sidewalk without it appearing hours later on her face.
Here, you must be tired from the trip. Come have some coffee and raisin cake,
Marianne said, starting toward the kitchen.
The children ate almost all of it, but I asked them to save some for you.
Vinita followed her.
Wash up, and I'll make the coffee,
Marianne said, as if Vinita were a child. And, like an obedient daughter, Vinita did as told.
I've been thinking, Marianne began as soon as she returned, that we should take a trip together with the children, show them something of Germany. We could go to Berlin first and visit Georg Bucher. Did Conny ever introduce you to him? They were always such dear friends. Or maybe into Munich to see Marienplatz and the Asamkirche. The boys are getting so old, and what do they know of their country? Nothing but all the bad things.
All right,
Vinita nodded, poking at her slice of cake.
Or, Marianne ventured, we could visit Helmut Kressing.
What is it?
She broke off at the sight of Benita's face.
To really dislike him so much?
No.
No, no,
Vinita said, shifting in her seat.
I just... There is something I need to tell you.
Of course,
Marianne said, sitting back.
You look so serious,
she laughed.
Is it a matter of life and death?
To her surprise, Vinita did not smile. Marianne could not sleep that night. She tried to believe it was the nap, but of course it was not. Benita's news was like a mouse crawling around in her head, nibbling on the wiring, pissing and shitting on her memories, creating electrical storms.
Benita Fledermann, wife of Martin Konstantin Fledermann, was to marry an ex-Nazi,
an ordinary carpenter turned member of the Orpo, a man with God knows how much blood on his hands. In Marianne's mind, he appeared as he had the morning he carried Vinita back from the woods, a giant man cradling a girl in his arms, covered in blood, like some monster from a legend. What had happened that morning was something she had never understood. Vinita had ventured out to warn Herr Müller of the Russians camped in front of the stable, and had been attacked. She had stabbed her attacker, and the man had run off. Herr Müller had found her and carried her back. This was the garbled story that Vinita recited. But Marianne never believed it. The next day, the Russians had come looking. One of them was missing. Marianne had said nothing, but of course she wondered. She could not imagine bird-brained, fragile Vinita stabbing anyone.
No.
Marianne felt certain it was Herr Müller who killed him. Possibly in defense of Vinita, possibly not. What was one more murder to a man who had served in Lublin? She had been right to tell Petermann to reassign him. Only she had been too late. But now, suddenly he was back. This time even closer, popping up beside the little skiff of a family she was steering. All these years, he'd been swimming alongside, beneath the surface. It was a shock and a betrayal.
I have failed you, Conny,
Marianne thought. It sounded melodramatic, but it was true. Take care of my wife, Conny had instructed her. Look out for my son. Don't let her marry a Nazi pig. Don't let a murderer take my place. That was implicit. Marianne swung her legs out of bed, pulled on her dressing gown, and went to the kitchen. To her